Down at the bottom of the garden, among the birds and the bees, there live a lot of little people called the Religious Studies Project. It's ringing bells somewhere. It's the Paddington Peas, man.
Oh,
Was that maybe too late
it
for
might have been
you?
too late for me. It might have been something that my little sister watched or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're drawing back the curtain on the
But
fact that I've got an old man pretending to be a
yeah.
young man on the internet.
But the Paddington Peas was, of course, well, I don't know if it was a British or American cartoon, but the fact is it was a cartoon which,
Involved vegetables.
but a cartoon which involved a culture that is a cultural product. It is something that is now transmitted digitally via YouTube and all sorts of things that people will, they'll be reconnecting with their childhoods through that. Someone who comments a lot on both film, cartoons, digital technologies, the internet is Dave McConaughey.
Yeah, no, wouldn't it be great to have an interview or perhaps a round table with Dave McConaughey right about now? Perhaps on the use of, how are cultures represented? How are things studied using digital technology?
If you just give me a little moment, I'll just. I think I've got one. This is Dave McConaughey's roundtable recorded at that camp with the Humanities and Technology Camp at the American Academy of Religion.
I am here at the table with several esteemed colleagues who all work on or are interested in digital religious studies. And we're here at the AAR Conference 2013 in Baltimore. We're all here participating in the AAR's first That Camp. I'm going to have everyone introduce themselves. I'm Dave McConaughey, a PhD from UCSB, now living in Orange County and independent scholar. And to my right is
Hussein Rashid. Did my PhD at Harvard, currently working as an adjunct at Hofstra University in New York. I work on Islam, America, and popular culture, and write for a couple of different venues publicly for religion and culture.
Excellent. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jerry Waringa. I'm a third-year PhD student at George Mason University, and I'm studying using digital technology for exploring the development of religious systems, and I'm looking at Seventh-day Adventism during the first about 50 or 70 years of their existence.
My name is Chris Catwell, and I teach public history and religious studies at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, and I'm interested in sort of the history of sort of evangelicalism and fundamentalism, but then also sort of any project that can use sort of, new media storytelling to take American religious history into the public. So,
I'm Lincoln Mullen. I'm a PhD student at Brandeis University, working on a dissertation about conversion between religions in the 19th century United States.
I'm Nathan Schneider. I'm a journalist based in New York. Write for different magazines and have books about God and Occupy. And I also work with the Social Science Research Council's online religion projects.
All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for agreeing to meet us here today. I know we have a busy schedule. I pre-circulated four questions for everyone who's here today. The first of which is, what does it mean to teach or research religious studies digitally? If there's anyone who feels compelled to speak first, feel free to jump right in, and if not, we'll put Hussein on the spot.
Yeah, I'm raring to go. I like this question. I like this question because I started getting interested in how do you use technology to teach about Islam. Almost 10 years ago, almost 12 years ago now, actually. And for me, it was an opportunity to show my students that how do people live their tradition? It's one thing to say, okay, this is what people live their tradition and get away from a textual approach, but if you couldn't actually show them stuff except this really grainy video footage or these old photos on slides, it was always back to the text, and it really enforced some of this thinking that religion only exists in text and not in people's lives. And so, for me, it's always been a great teaching tool, and especially as we've got better technology and people are traveling over the world and putting stuff on YouTube and Flickr to say, hey, go look at how people live their lives and look at how this interacts with this textual stuff we're doing.
Right. So it was a connection point for you between what people were doing out in their lives and the way that we can represent that better
Yeah, I think it very much is along those lines. Again, moving off text and saying that religion has meaning to people besides liturgical service, you know, and what we think of as religion, the way it's just, it's manifested in culture, whether it's signs on walls or dances or songs, music, doodles even sometimes pop up. So it's just, it was a great way to show some of that.
Great. Anybody else?
Yeah, I have an answer that's been rearing to go on this for a while. I mean, I approach this more as a question as what is the relationship between religious studies and the digital humanities? Mm. And the answer to that question is there really hasn't been a relationship for a while, which is why I think this is a very interesting question. You know, you mentioned that this is the first ever ThatCamp AAR sponsored. While, you know, ThatCamp's been around since 2008, you know, most major scholarly associations have had these kind of, you know, technology and humanities kind of gatherings before. So why has it taken religious studies so long is an interesting question. And I think it's kind of, it's an unfortunate sort of legacy because, you know, many can claim that sort of religious studies began sort of the digital humanities in a way, which is why I think this is really interesting because, you know, the digital humanities really began sort of the 1940s and 1950s when Father Robert Broussa, who's a Jesuit priest, began cataloging everything St. Thomas Aquinas ever wrote and built sort of a searchable database of Aquinas' writings. So there's a way in which, you know, religious studies can claim, you know, a lineage as sort of being a part of this. So there's that in that, you know, you can, the scholars have been using digital technology to study religion for a long time. So that's one aspect of it. But another aspect that I think that this relationship, the lack of relationships unfortunate is because the ways in which sort of people approach digital technology is ripe for the study of the sacred and religion, right? I mean, big data is kind of a belief, right? We believe in data, like it tells us something. And so in that way, I think you can't even approach sort of seemingly secular technological rituals without the theoretical tools that religious studies gives you. So I see that sort of both, you know, the ways in which it's been around in the past is also the way in which our contemporary environment is ripe for using the language and the theory of religious studies to understand sort of the digital realm.
I think that's really interesting that both of you suggest that the method that we use is producing really distinct kind of analyses of the object that we're studying, right? So if we're looking at, you know, the writings of Aquinas, like putting that into a framework where you can research all of them, you can search the text, right? That really changes the kind of relationship you can have with that kind of document. And the same for Hussein's subjects, right? That those texts become accessible and the interactions with those texts become revealed in a new way, right?
Yeah, but it's the connection between, so that, you know, Broussa was doing this really early on in the 40s and 50s,
sure.
But then it's that extra step to saying, like, he believed that kind of, you know, studying Aquinas in aggregate told us something else.
Right,
like,
right.
That's not a, I mean, that is as much a theological position as it is an academic position,
right,
and so
right.
That's what I'm interested in.
So that raises a second really interesting question, which is, you know, is there a theological element to the method, right? That seems to be what you're suggesting, right?
Well, I wouldn't say theological, but it's certainly... I don't know.
It's a grand unified theory of everything.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That I think cuts across disciplines. We're always looking for that thing that allows us to see patterns in new ways.
Right.
Or to find those patterns and figure out how everything fits together.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, is that a...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And it makes us want to be sure to be very critical as we approach these methods and be aware not only of what it enables us to find and what new kind of possibilities are opened up, but then also what is lost. You know, when you're only looking at digital data, what are you then not seeing? Who doesn't have access to producing that data?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the power of sometimes turning off the digital?
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's been tremendously important not only to do a lot of reporting online, but also to make sure that I'm talking to people who aren't online all the time and have to find, you know, you learn things that you just can never find otherwise. And I think religious studies methodologies, the criticality about, say, the concept of religion and about the different fields around that, call us to be critical also about the digital in really deep ways, in ways Chris is pointing to as well.
And I think, Nathan, you hit on something really important in terms of what are we missing out when we rely on the digital, because I think as great as digital technology has been in terms of looking for patterns, gathering data, especially somebody who's interested in cultural production, a lot of that stuff doesn't get captured. Particular movements of the body, calligraphic artwork, although some of those static images, of course, we're getting better at mapping, but human bodily emotions, expressions, that you can only see when you see 10,000 hours of video, and you start saying, oh, this is a really emotive experience because of XYZ. You can never capture digitally. It's a tool to get you to see other things, but that vehicle isn't there yet, I don't think, to capture a lot of that human emotional side of it.
Following on from some of the points that have been made about the ubiquity and the need for criticism, is the observation that we're all sort of bound to teach digitally now. It simply can't be avoided. And I'll give you an example of that. So unless you have your students using the card catalog at the library, then they have to use a digital method of accessing this way of cataloging and storing human knowledge. And I want to suggest that that really fundamentally changes the game about how we're teaching and doing our own research. And one of the best parts about that is this access to a lot more things for the classroom than even 5 or 10 years ago. Now that Google Books has won its lawsuit, that seems like it could be a pretty secure source. Recent more public venues like the Digital Public Library of America and other places that are putting up these kinds of sources allow students to access just sort of a wealth of materials, primary materials, that otherwise they might not.
And just to push back a little bit on the, while I agree that you can't capture a lot of the affective or performative aspects of religion when looking just at text, there still is a lot of need to mine the texts more systematically and looking across large collections of texts, both within religious traditions and outside religious traditions. And so I think researching religion digitally offers great opportunities to compare across and see broader conversations.
I don't want to discount the value of searching text at all. I think it's incredibly important. I think it's really the core of what we do, because then you start getting to the performative. But I think we have to acknowledge that the performative can get lost if we have to stay with digital. So
agreed.
That's sort of the division I want to make. Yeah.
So let's build on that kind of performative and the big data and also the risks of big data, and ask whether or not within the broader digital humanities movement, whether there's something really distinct to the kind of data that we might be studying within digital religious studies. Mm. So do we get a special marker for being religious studies? Is that marker data in some way? Or are we just looking at one more object like all the rest of the humanities are looking at? One more object. Is our data special?
Of course, we're always special. So I want to dissent a little bit from the idea of big data. So there's a couple of things that you could mean by that. Sometimes people by big data think they mean data about big things, like the population of the world is a big number. But that's not in itself a big data. But there's a technical meaning to the idea of big data, which is data that you can't analyze through normal means. For example, when Google keeps track of all the people that hit their websites, you know, just millions and billions of pieces of data. We humanists, unfortunately, are probably never going to have that kind of problem unless we study the 21st century. Certainly in the 19th century, we're talking about megabytes of data rather than terabytes or petabytes. So a lot of the ways that we deal with data are not these big data things which are being talked about, in which so much faith is being put, as Chris pointed out earlier. But really, we're dealing with older historical, social, scientific ways of studying the world. These can be, in some cases, quantitative, and other times they can be qualitative. So what I'm trying to suggest is, while the digital humanities is new, it's really building upon a lot of other ways that we've dealt with these kinds of sources before. So we're not entirely adrift.
I mean, I completely agree. I think one of the things that makes the data that I'm in particular looking at distinct is just how the tradition of writing in religious cultures gives so much of a rich source base to work with and makes it a very useful subject for text analysis, because people are reflecting on how they see themselves and how they see themselves in connection to an understanding of the world in larger patterns. So in that sense, I think religious data that's being written is very productive and could offer huge opportunities for digital research.
I just want to say one thing about data, which is that sometimes scholars get a little giddy when you start talking about data. Other scholars start gritting their teeth as soon as you say the word data. But none of these are necessary exclusive ways of working with our sources. Either different scholars have different approaches, which are can be complementary rather than contradictory, and even the same scholar can have a very humanistic sort of close reading analysis of some texts, while at the same time they're using these data approaches.
I think in terms of thinking about data, one of the things that I've been interested in, I'm not a Quran scholar by any stretch of the imagination, but as somebody who works with Islamic communities and studies Islam, I obviously have a working knowledge and teach the Quran quite a bit. And there's a whole field talking about how the Quran quotes other texts. And the Quran is sort of self-referential, and it says we're quoting other texts, and you know, they seem to be quoting non-canonical gospels and language that isn't properly Arabic and you know needs a strong philological approach to it. But I think because of the script systems used, this is a place that strikes me as being great for sort of digital analysis. But because the script systems, which are right to left, touch Aramaic, Hebrew, Arabic, Proto-Arabic, you know, that they're not, you can't sort of combine that in that way. It'll be great to see some language drift, you know, this genetic language theory that we've been looking at, how we can trace back origins of word, I think would be great for some of our scriptural work. But we just don't have the ability yet because of the language ability.
So the digital kind of world may provide a platform for accessing new research methods, new interpretive alleys.
I absolutely think so. But again, the problem is, you know, how many people who are doing right to left, multi-language, languages. You know, are working on this material.
Yeah, and you had asked, you know, Dave, what marks data
sure.
as sort of a religious studies data that might be different from the way in other digital humanists do their work. And I think sort of the question of sort of markup languages for scripture as the ways in which it breaks with not only sort of, you know, conventional writing standards, quote-unquote, but also just the what tags and markings you'd want to give to certain phrases that sort of exist outside sort of contemporary poetry or even 18th century poetry, right? Like, how do you mark up the Psalms as opposed to marking up, you know, pound, Ezra Pound or something like that? Yeah.
And this points out how, in some ways, we're at the mercy of the people that make the technologies. You know, if it weren't for Unicode, we wouldn't really have much hope of doing these non-Roman character texts. But on the other hand, humanists and religious studies have an opportunity to contribute back to these kind of things. So, I think of a great project like TEI, which thinks through things like dates and how do you think about people and so on and so forth.
Can you say what TEI is?
Oh, sure. TEI is the Text Encoding Initiative, and it's a XML-based schema for marking up texts, widely used by people in the English department, anybody who's working closely with text. But it's the thinking through how you represent uncertainty and ambiguity and those kinds of things, which I think people in the religious studies and religious history can contribute back to the technology at the same time that we are sort of dependent upon what the technologies come up for us.
So I've heard your kind of suggestion that there is, the TI is a great example of a kind of element, right, within the kind of toolbox that we have. I asked everyone beforehand if they could think of some projects where religious studies was particularly being exemplified in the digital world. That may be easy or hard for you. but while Hussein was speaking, one of the projects that I was thinking of that's not for my own work, although I have been really impressed with it, is the digital repository for the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? Which has been, that's out of Harvard, right? That has been an extremely valuable resource, I know, for early Christian scholars and scholars of early Christian era Judaica. So I mean, I know that that's one area where exactly the Unicode texting, right, of having crowdsourcing the translation of those materials, displaying images that, you know, for that volume of people to study would be impossible otherwise, right? So they're allowing access to an archive where looking at the material might damage it irreparably, right? So there's all those kind of great things. Are there other projects that we might lead people to if they wanted to kind of explore some of the ways that religious studies is appearing digitally?
Well, I said this earlier. I'd like to put our own Lincoln Mullen on the spot here, because the project I really like is a project that he has developed to go alongside his research to make his research more open source and public on the American Converts database. So you want to... I could sell it, but you can sell it too. Okay.
So it's not just me. I'm working with a scholar at the University of Connecticut, Aaron Bartram, and we've had, I think, about a dozen scholars who've contributed so far. And the idea is that this is a database of people who switched religions or had conversion experiences in American religious history. Of course, we have no hope of getting everybody who ever had a conversion experience, since it's in the millions. But the idea is to make these available, especially archival sources. So one scholar, Sherry Rabin at Yale University, has been sending lots of converts to Judaism that she's found in the American Jewish Archives in Cincinnati, and I have some from the Center for Jewish History, which otherwise scholars would not necessarily know about because they're much harder to find. And so the idea there is that this is kind of like an open notebook of our research, so that people can find the individual converts and find information about them, but also that it adds up to be something in the aggregate more than what it would be individually, so that we can figure out when people converted most often, where they converted, and look at the database in the aggregate like that.
Well, what the Social Science Research Council's been doing is a series of publication projects, which in turn end up affecting how research can be done and what research might look like. And these include, like, the Immanent Frame, which is a series of discussions. It's been going on for a number of years now about secularism and the public sphere. And then one called Frequencies, which is about contemporary spirituality. One called Reverberations, about prayer. And in each of these cases, just by setting up a kind of blogging platform with Frequencies, it was a much more kind of innovative, built from the ground up site. But in each case, we were able to bring scholars a little bit out of their shell in terms of how they were communicating what they were doing, the temporal cycle of scholarship, enabling them to get shorter publications out more quickly. Mm-hmm. And and by doing that strategically, on the one hand, we saw people doing kinds of writing that we'd never seen them doing before. In some cases, that was really exciting, and in many cases. And then also, by having them do that, it created a sense that, okay, this is okay for scholars to do, and it kind of created space and a new kind of conversation and allowed new subjects of study to emerge in the process. So in that way, the space that digital publication allows can change how we do research.
I'm going to bring it to something I think a little bit more mundane, which is using some of this material in the classroom. I was one of the early anti-war bloggers back in 2003, probably still one of the longest running American Muslim blogs. And so I've built a good network of contacts within the American Muslim blogging community. And we now have these sort of big archives. Things are sort of shaken out. That Wild West of the blogging world isn't there anymore. There's sort of these heavyweights. There's the scholarly ones that Nathan's mentioned. There's places like Killing the Buddha, Pathios, Religion Dispatches, Sacred Matters, where you can find these people. And what I've tried to do is when I send students out to read this, and again, to come back to this, this is a lived tradition, is that this may be a blog post reading from a month ago, but then to see if I can get the author of the blog to Skype in that I'm having them read, or now Google Hangouts, which I much prefer, but to have that sort of interaction. And I have to say, it's just done wonders for them to realize that, because it's still dead on a screen, right? Even though maybe a month old, it's still dead. And to meet that person who wrote that and have that conversation, I think is very different. And I think now that we've settled into these bigger archives, it's much easier to have this human interaction in a way that wasn't possible even 6 years ago.
Well, this is a slightly different twist on this question, but so I help work with digital humanities now, which is the other side of this, and we actually see very little from religious studies. So this is kind of a plea for getting more engagement and more religious scholars to start contributing their work and raising awareness. We follow RSS feeds, so if we don't see it, if we're not following you, we're not picking it up. So there's a need for digital religious studies and digital humanities to be much more in conversation so that we can see each other.
So let me build off of that and have the final question here. We're pressed for time as we're all fitting this in our lunch hour today. So perhaps everyone can go around and suggest one or two ways that departments in the field can better support digital methods and pedagogies. Is there something that you think that as a field we could do to prop up the kind of work that we're doing and the kind of innovations that it might provide to us? So
of all the VAC camps that I've been to, there's a very large number of librarians and archivists, museum studies, folks who come, also educational technology. Where normally you might not happen to run into those people at a disciplinary kind of conference like the AAR and the AHA. So I think a really good first step is to get to know the people in your library who do this kind of work, who are thinking about it, and are, frankly, probably quite a few steps ahead of most faculty and graduate students in thinking through these materials. And they can really be helpful in guiding you along the way.
Excellent.
And piggybacking on that, support for housing, especially when working with data, places where the data can live so that it has longevity, so that these projects can last longer than as long as I pay for my web space. Institutional support for that would really be useful.
Yeah, I think getting out of your department or, you know, meeting people outside of your field is really important to sort of encourage this because, I mean, as Jerry pointed out, there's not a lot in the field, so you need to sort of connect and network with other people. But alongside it, so to say something maybe different, I mean, that would be my first answer. But as somebody who just joined the tenure track, I think if the field could sort of start drawing sort of standards and guidelines for what digital scholarship means as scholarship, that I think would sort of go... Exactly, yeah. I mean, does it relate to a journal article? Does it relate to a monograph? Like, what kind of standards and metrics do we use to measure and judge and evaluate digital scholarship? I think if sort of the field would arrive at sort of a consensus of what counts as good scholarship in the digital realm, then you would see a flourishing of this work because there's an incentive to do so for people on whose sort of pay and long-term employment, you know, rests on the evaluation of their scholarship. So
that's a great point. And some places like the MLA have really started to do
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
But much more could be done by all the disciplinary organizations.
Yeah, it really seems like there's an interest and there's a momentum to start recognizing this. It just needs to actually happen now. Yeah. And that will sort of, I think, open the dam. So.
The wheels of the academy take a while
right.
to turn.
Exactly.
Because
yeah, yeah.
I know that digital humanities generally has been talking about this for 4 or 5 years, right?
Oh, really, gosh, really like 10 probably.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
But like seriously, seriously pushing it forward and actually having some success in getting some admissions at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Nathan, you said you want to add?
Yeah, I think to add to that is the consideration of platforms, not just
yeah.
the content, but the platforms. What are the appropriate platforms for scholarly production and dissemination?
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now, scholarly journals were once a way to disseminate information more widely than one might otherwise be able to. Now, so many of them are behind paywalls while other things are not, that they're actually less accessible for the public than other kinds of information.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's really important that we think about using open technologies, also being very conscious of ways in which we expose our students publicly
mm-hmm.
When we ask them to do digital work, to be conscious of privacy, the kind of manifestations and consequences of these technologies, and we help our students think critically about the technology as well as about the content.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I just want to echo, we need to be much more conscious and multidisciplinary. I think religion tends to lend itself to that,
mm-hmm.
But I think institutionally sometimes it's a bit harder. I think that we need to think about what this means in terms of tenure track, especially for junior faculty who tend to be the ones doing this, what counts as scholarship. I think, Nathan, what you've talked about is spot on in terms of broader digital literacy. But I think working off what you and Jerry said is also, I've worked with some really great institutions where we've had great IT departments who are willing to share best practices with us, but it's best practices, what's already happened, and how do we create spaces that are actually generative? And, you know, we get so caught up in some of our content management systems and our big contracts that some of the better tools are not actually available to us unless we fight and claw and actually have to move outside our system, in which case we don't get that support. So how do we create generative spaces digitally, as well as in terms of the library and archives?
Thanks again to Dave for recording that and all the participants for taking part. We're very happy to have been able to bring that from the AAR and from the That Camp organisers, because obviously the use of technology, digital technology, social media in the dissemination of RS research and the humanities more broadly is a major concern and objective of ours and the religious studies project.
And we've just been discussing before this recording how myself and hopefully Jack Sonis, Jack, this might be the first time you hear about it, but I'll try and email you before this goes out, are going to try and put together a piece for the BASR Bulletin on indeed how the RSP as a podcast and indeed the whole web resource has been utilised in the teaching and dissemination of RS
and we should try and share that through the site as well. That would be great.
It's another one from Tommy next week.
Yeah, now, Chris, I was a bit puzzled when I read the title of this, Sources of Meaning. I mean, that sounds a little bit theological to me.
Yeah. The interview is with Tatiana Schnell on Sources of Meaning. But Sources of Meaning is tends to be abbreviated as SOMI. It's an index that's used within psychology.
Sources of Meaning Index.
And this is a lot of relevance because, you know, people tend to associate, oh, religious studies, you're studying meaning. You must be studying the big questions,
big things like that.
And I often get asked, you know, when I'm looking at people whose primary identification in numerous circumstances is as being different from religious, I get asked, well, why are you even interested in the category of religion then? Why aren't you looking at meaning making, how they make meaning in their lives, what matters to them? And well, if I were in meaning studies, perhaps I would be doing that, but unfortunately I'm in religious studies, so I'm interested in their relationships with the category of religion. But it's a very important area of research, I think, is to be trying to, again, as with the religion, spirituality, and health, trying to, you know, find links between this common stereotype that religion is about meaning making, and try and, you know, unpick that a bit.
So. I'm thinking back to what we said in the Koenig interview last week about, you know, maybe folk categories getting reproduced here, but I mean, I hear what you're saying. Who was it that had the definition of religion as matters of ultimate importance?
That's Paul Tillich.
Tillich, yeah.
Ultimate concern.
Ultimate concern. So, I mean, this is, yeah. This kind of discourse is reproduced ethically as well as emically. Mm-hmm. So it'd be interesting to see how we hear that. Now, you're going to a conference, aren't you?
I am, yeah. I've just heard from Dr. Jenny Butler that I sort of have carte blanche, in a sense, to record at the Irish Society for the Academic Study of Religion conference, which is happening at the end of May in Queen's University in Belfast. So I do get to visit my folks, I get to stay with friends, and I also get to spend 2 or 3 days talking about the things that really matter, my source of meaning, which is religious studies.
Making a career in academia.
Yeah. I know I'm going to be meeting, touchwood, Owen O'Mahony. He's been a great supporter of the project. Yeah, I'm sure I'll meet some other folk too. So we'll hopefully get a few conversations.
Maybe if you're listening, Owen, maybe we can get you to do a tag or something at the beginning. That'd be great.
Yeah,
we should start a tradition of people doing that. Right, so start thinking of obscure quotes now.
And we'll have our first RSP stuff recorded on in Belfast then, despite the fact that I've been back and forth over there many times since we started.
We've never had anything recorded in Inverness either. No,
we will manage it sometime. We'll just take a car up just for the sake of it.
Edinburgh is our spiritual home, that's the...
On another note, we've also worked out that I'm 90% sure that I'm going to get to meet the legend that is Thomas J. Coleman III.
Thomas Coleman!
In the flesh, and when he's in the UK in May. So hopefully there'll be some recording shenanigans.
Yeah, I'm thinking I might step down as co-host for that week and let Tommy take over. And then you can just run off with the religious studies project.
Thanks, David.
That'll be great. Yeah.
I've got that.
No, you're welcome.
As always, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, on Google+, on Twitter, on iTunes. You can get the podcast from there. If you're using Amazon regularly, please do try and use our links. We have UK, Canada and US links there. We get a cut of what you spend without you having to spend any extra. It's a way of supporting the project at no extra cost to yourself, and it really does mean a lot to us. If you're subscribing to us on iTunes, please do give us a rating. That would help us enormously to get this podcast out to people beyond the boundaries of religious studies. But I think the most important thing for you to remember, other than the fact that the BASR are awesome and our sponsors, is thanks for listening.